Deutschlandfunk Kultur. Sein und Streit.
Hello, my name is Catherine Newmark and this is the philosophy program of Deutschlandfunk Kultur. And the reason we are doing this in English today is my guest. Here in the studio sitting opposite me is Manon Garcia. Welcome, Manon Garcia.
Thank you, hello.
Manon Garcia hails from France, but she spent quite a few years in the US, in Harvard and Yale in particular, and she has been a professor at the Freie Universität here in Berlin since last year. She is known for her work in feminist philosophy. We Are Not Born Submissive, How Patriarchy Shapes Women's Lives was published in 2018 in French and in 2021 in German and English, among other languages. And her latest book is entitled La Conversation des Sexes, Philosophie du Consentement. It came out in France in 2021 and is just out in English under the title The Joy of Consent, A Philosophy of Good Sex, which I think sounds promising. In German, it has also just come out under the title Das Gespräch der Geschlechter, eine Philosophie der Zustimmung, which sounds a little bit more wholesome, should we say. And it is, of course, on this subject of consent that I want to speak to Manon Garcia today. Manon, do you consent to this conversation?
I do.
That is excellent. Now, consent has become a big topic, of course, not just in feminist philosophy and theory, but in society at large, in the wake of the Me Too movement, of the Me Too debates in the last few years. And there has been a concerted push in feminist and more broadly progressive social and legal thinking to put consent at the heart of what is legal and permissible sex, as opposed to rape. Now, your book, Manon, sets out to complicate this concept and to question it. And you do this in many convincing ways, some of them quite theoretical. But I think what we should maybe begin with is some examples, because I think the examples of scenarios that you bring up throughout your book are quite useful to understand the scale of the problem. Now, I could try and illustrate the concept of consent with the following scenario. Last night, I asked my husband, could we please have sex? And he said, no, I am tired and I have a headache. He did not consent, hence we didn't have sex. This example is, of course, wholly imaginary. I am in my mid-40s and we have two children and jobs. Why is... But just to illustrate the point, Manon Garcia, why is this example not enough to illustrate the problem of consent?
So it's interesting because the very fact that you're presenting the example that way makes it different from everything we read about consent, because the only question people ask about consent is about the woman's consent. It seems evident for philosophers, for political theorists, but also for the public at large that men always want sex. So your husband is being a bit weird in that example.
He is weird.
And women, on the other hand, always have to be convinced or to be conquered, that there's a sort of hunter-prey dynamic going on. And so this is one of the things that I was very interested in. So you have this, for instance, very famous philosopher of sexual ethics who wrote the book on sexual consent called Alan Wertheimer, who says, well, the goal of my book is to know when a woman wants to have sex or not. And so this is the beginning, right? Like, why do we think that this is the question? And also in the example you give, what is funny is that you're thinking, okay, he said no, we don't have sex. But that's not how things usually work. Because very often, people don't say no. They say something like, well, I don't know, yeah, maybe. And so is this consent? Is it not consent? Or very often people insist. They say, well, it's been a week. When are we going to have sex? If we're not having sex tonight, you always say no. You always use the kids as an excuse, etc. Like, are you going to tell me you have a headache now? And then we understand that a lot is going on behind this idea of consent about gender, about social pressure, about what is the norm, about what is good sex, what is bad sex, what should be allowed. So imagine if it were the 300th time that you had asked your husband and he had said no. So would you be allowed to be mad at him? Or what if it had never happened that you were the one asking? Does it change the situation? Or what if actually you knew that your husband was going through something really hard and sex would really help him, and but that you knew that it would be hard for him to get started, but that because you love him and because you know him very intimately, you would know that in the end, he would feel better if you were to have sex. Like, would it give you a right to insist about the sex, to say, hey, like, I know right now you don't feel like it, but I promise you that if we do, then you're going to feel better and you're going to have a better week. So I'm interested in all these subtleties, all these thick descriptions. How, like, can we really interpret this example outside of your relationship dynamic? Would it be the same if it were not your husband, but someone you had just met that night? And or if it were a woman and you were a man? So that's what I'm interested in.
Thank you. This was very illuminating, all of the subtleties. And we're just now speaking within, I mean, all of the subtleties that you brought out of the situation were just to do within what you assume is a happy marriage and a long-term relationship. And even there, there's a lot of complexity to the question, quite apart from the fact that generally the beginning, the commencement of sex is possibly not, hey, should we have sex? It's not that explicitly verbally. So you say the concept of consent isn't quite so clear. And it's interesting, actually, because in English, at least, and I think to a degree in French, the consent, le consentement, has become a sort of a firm concept, which we also associate very strongly with the idea of sexual consent. I mean, there are other types of consents and your book deals with them quite extensively, but sexual consent has become sort of a firm concept. Interestingly enough, in German, this doesn't seem to be quite so much the case. I mean, there is a reason that your book has been called Eine Philosophie der Zustimmung. And there's also, I mean, we talk about einvernehmlicher Sex, but it's not a firm concept. So what is the situation here in Germany? Would you say that there is not, the debate has not gone this far, or we just use other words, or maybe just to clarify this conceptual problem here in the translation?
It's very interesting. It was very interesting for me when I arrived in Germany, because it seems in many ways like Germany is really behind in the discussion about sexual consent. But I actually think it's a bit more subtle than this. I think it comes also from the fact that German is a much more precise language. So I'm going to get back to this. But basically, the concept of consent in English and consentement in French, it's very clear. It is used in law, for contract or for criminal law. It is used in politics to talk about, you know, from Locke onwards, to understand what the population does towards the power in place. And it is used in the sexual realm. And I think in all these realms, there is an ambiguity at the heart of the concept. That is, that consent means both to accept something and to want something. So, of course, in the realm of sex, it's extremely interesting because it's been used to say, well, the only thing that matters is that women are not against the sex that is offered to them or that is done to them. But we can still use it to say, well, okay, but we should actually understand that what matters is that women actually want the sex they're having and that men also want the sex they're having. And so there's the room inside the concept to make it an emancipatory concept. And I think in German, it's a bit more complicated because in the book, the way the translator translated my words is that when I used the adjective consented, she said einvernehmlich. And when I was using the concept consent, she used Zustimmung, with the idea that this way you would have the acceptation and choice at the same time. But there is also in consent the idea of Konsens or Einwilligung. And so I think just German is more precise. And so probably if I had written this book in German from the get-go, I would probably have done something. Instead of saying we should salvage the notion of consent, I would have said, oh, we should probably move on from sexuelle Zustimmung to sexuelle Konsens. But you would have to change the concept in German, whereas in English and in French, you don't.
All three concepts, the Zustimmung as well as consent or consentement, does have the Stimmung or the sense in it, the sensibility. And I think that is probably where we will end, because that is a sort of an element of it that is quite important to your, not solution, I wouldn't say that you solve the problem of sexual consent, but to your sort of idea of the direction we should be taking with this problem. But let's get back to the ideas of consent as a contract, because it seems that to a certain degree, also in this rather artificial example with which I began, there is a tendency to think of sexual consent in a contractual way, as if, like, we need to negotiate what we want to do and we need to put it down on paper. And it's at the heart also of a polemic conservative criticism of ideas of sexual consent, but it's also to a degree at the heart of a lot of ideas of what consent means. It means explicit, willing, self-aware, self-knowledgeable, knowing what I want, consent, contractual, which would have the dignity of a contract. Now, sexual situations are rarely like that, I think, is what you try to tell us.
Yes, so I think the use of the contract or the image of the contract comes partly from a misunderstanding of law, right? Of the fact that in law, you use the concept of Zustimmung for or consent for two different things. One is for contracts and another one is for criminal law, because there are certain crimes like rape, but like kidnapping, that only exist if the victim doesn't consent. You can't kidnap someone with their agreement, or you can't rape someone with their agreement. And so initially it didn't really make sense to understand sexual consent through contract, because these are just two different realms of law. And for instance, like, no one would ever think that sexual consent is a form of promise. Like, you could say, oh, okay, like, I promise you I'm going to have sex with you on Friday. And then you could say, well, now you say you don't want to have sex anymore. You owe me money. Like, if you sign a contract about anything else. That being said, I think the model of the contract, so that's part of what I'm trying to do in the book, is to show the liberal route of the use of the contract to understand what happens sexually, is that the model of the contract shows to us that we understand consent as a manifestation of the autonomy of the will. And so we take this seriously. We understand consent as the way we formally give our agreement to something. But here, what happens in the background is that it means we move on to a liberal vision of the world, in which, and so this is, in my opinion, one of the big problems with the discourse on consent, is that it simplifies everything. And one of the simplification is that it considers the people who are having sex as in a vat, as completely isolated from society, and it's pretending that it's two people who are already transparent to themselves, who know what they like, etc., who will engage in a negotiation about what they're going to do. But the reality is that we're never abstracted from society. And if there's one thing that feminists, among other people, have shown us, is that sex is political, and that what we want and what we do sexually is very heavily shaped by the social world, and that we also don't know what we want and what we like from the get-go. And so these simplifications of understanding sexual consent as two people who know exactly what they want, who are not influenced by society and enter a negotiation, this is a fiction that is completely different from reality, and that is simplistic for this reason.
It's a fiction, it's a simplistic fiction, and as you quite, I think, eloquently show, it's not a useful fiction. It's not a fiction that actually Sometimes simplistic fictions might be helpful to understanding a problem. In this case, you claim it isn't. Now, one model for contracts in sexuality is, of course, also the types of contracts that we know from the sexual subculture that is generally named BDSM, bondage, domination, sadomasochism, this whole area where people do things that might be considered illegal to each other, but they consent to them and they try to protect themselves from the accusation of this being abusive by doing quite explicit contracts. And in a way, you could say, this is wonderfully avant-garde because people are completely transparent to themselves. They know exactly what they want. They negotiate it, they write it down, and then they do that. So in a way, you could say this type of idea also influences the idea of consent. But it might be the case that this type of very explicit negotiation of sexuality is more subcultural or not quite as widespread as one would want to make it if one extends it to the realm of sexuality as a whole. Is that correct?
Yes. So I actually spend a lot of time, as you know, in the book talking about BDSM for several reasons. First of all, because, of course, BDSM is the subculture in which consent started being understood as a contract. But this has two reasons. One is that writing very long contracts about sex is extremely sexy. And so it's part actually of the pleasure of the build up of sexual tension to negotiate sex and say, would you agree if I were to do this to you? And would you agree if I were to do that? So it's kind of foreplay. So I think this is something we need to keep in mind, that language has a very strong sexual power. And this is why I think it's completely stupid, this reactionary view that if we were to start talking about sex, it would make sex way less pleasurable. It's actually the opposite. If instead of telling your husband, are you down for sex tonight, you would say, what could I do to you tonight that would really arouse you? Like, would you be down if I were to do this to you? And if I were to do that, like, that would be super sexy. That could be at least super sexy. So there's that I wanted to show. And then there's a very specific situation of that subculture that you mentioned, which is that because what they do sexually could look like battery, it was very important for them to be able to say, we have a very clear line between what is sex and what is violence. And this contract is a way to draw this line and to make sure that we're not exerting violence on each other. And I think this is all the more important because they are experimenting with risk. Because fundamentally, what you want to do in a BDSM relationship is try your limits, is try things that you're not sure that you're going to like, or that actually you might really find horrible and you would want to stop them immediately. And so in order to be able to explore, they understood that you need to organize a sort of set of rules that make this exploration possible. And there, and this is the last reason why I use it so much, is that there I think BDSM is a good model for us. It's a good way of thinking about something that happens with sex, which is the fact that we don't know what we like and we need to be able to try. And so if we think that the only kind of sex that is acceptable is sex we're going to enjoy, then, like, how are we going to try things? Because you can't know for sure that you're going to enjoy things. And so that leads me to a core distinction that I'm trying to make in the book. I'm trying to say we need to talk about sex from a moral perspective, not in the sense of being moralistic, but in the sense of thinking what makes our actions good, what makes our actions permissible, etc. And so I want to show that there are actually two questions. There's a question of freedom, or some Anglophone philosophers call negative freedom, of saying what should not be done to you so that you remain free. So this is basically the distinction between permissible and impermissible sex. And so there we want consent to play a role. But there is another question, which is the question of morally good sex. But there we tend to think, oh, but if we talk about morally good sex, we're going to be moralistic. We're going to be telling people how they should have sex. And we know in the past that the result of this has been to tell everyone that they couldn't be gay, that they couldn't use the pill, or that they should just want to have heterosexual, long-term monogamous relationships, etc. But I still think this question is valuable, that we don't need to respond to it in a moralistic way, but that another reason why we're struggling so hard with responding to it is because we think that good sex is sex that feels good and bad sex is sex that feels bad. But actually, in order to have morally good sex, it's very likely that you're going to have sometimes sex that doesn't feel great, but not in the sense that you were forced to do it, but in the sense that you tried things and you figured out that actually you don't like them. And so how can we take this into account in our definition of good sex? Another case, since we were talking about examples, is that we need to recognize that sometimes you have sex not because it's going to be your best orgasm ever. So an example of that is when you're trying to conceive, right? You want to have a kid and it's been months and it's not working. And so you have to tell your partner, sorry, honey, but it's today and in the next 2 days, we're going to need to have a lot of sex. So please, like, let's lie down and go for it. It's very likely that it's not going to be the best sex you've ever had. But because it corresponds to goals you have in life and things that really matter to you, it can and it very often is morally good sex. And so we need to be able to enter the field of sexual ethics with precision and with this idea that sex has to do with freedom, but also with happiness. And we need to bring back those two questions into sexual ethics.
Wonderful. Thank you for moving us straight from the BDSM contract to the moral questions. I mean, the questions of morality are, and I find this interesting in your book, they are somewhat localized. There are anxieties surrounding morality that are somewhat different in different places. I found it, there are traces of Frenchness in your book in the sense that in France there is a great amount of almost hysterical fear that you will be forbidden to flirt. That Me Too is basically going to ruin sexuality because you have to talk about it, because you're not allowed to just do the sort of these things that nobody wants to speak of. So I think you deconstruct this idea that sexuality should be outside of the things we talk about very well. And I think the danger that is always there when you say morally good sex is that people think of moralistic. But of course, you bring this back to a much larger philosophical idea, to sort of a Kantian idea of Menschenwürde, of sort of human dignity. Morally good is not what the Puritans or the church or the state wants you to have, what sort of sex they want you to have. We're really not on that realm. We're on the realm of self-fulfillment and the realm of the human freedom and human dignity when you speak about the moral question of sex. Is that correct?
Yes, it's interesting that you talk about how French this book is, because when I think the reason why I wrote it is because I'm indeed French and grew up in France and started thinking about these questions in France. And then I moved to the US. And so I was living in the US when Me Too happened. And it was so interesting for me to see this sort of clash of cliches. You had kind of the cliche of French people who were thinking that Americans don't have sex, don't know to have sex, and they're only talking about consent because they're just really bad at sex.
And
so I could see my friends in France telling me, so on American campuses, no one has sex anymore, huh? It's not like us, ha, 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 etc. And on the other hand, the Americans who were telling me, like, what is the problem with French people? You're so obsessed with sex that it becomes rape and no one cares. Like, there's sexual assault everywhere, sexual harassment everywhere. And so I was in the middle of this sort of conflict of views about consent, where French people really thought that consent was kind of the tool the imperialist Americans were using to destroy the art of love a la française, you know, and that it would be the end of us. And it was very interesting because in the context of writing this book, I found a passage in the Voyage au bout de la nuit from Céline in the 30s, where he's already saying, so in 1930s, French people were already very worried that the Anglo-Saxon would bring consent to destroy so he has this untranslatable passage. He says, la gaudriole des arrière-boutiques. So what he means by that is destroy the joy of accidental sex in the back store. And of course, when you read it today, you're like, are you talking about a boss forcing his employee to have sex in the back store? Because that's also a lot of what this back store sex was happening. And so, of course, there is something about how do we disintricate the sexual violence from sexual pleasure. And it's something French people are very concerned about regarding Germany. They tell you, oh yeah, in Germany, no one flirts. And so there are a lot of these articles about how in Germany, young people don't have sex anymore because they don't know how to flirt. And I think there may be some truth to it but French people tell you, oh, it's because they brought respect to such a level that they can't go on to have sex anymore. And so I'm interested in this, like, how do we imagine what sex could be in a world where sex is not violence? And this is actually very difficult because what we collectively, socially find sexy has to do with power dynamics. And so there's this, Gloria Steinem, the historical American feminist, who said, we need to eroticize equality. But it's actually really hard to eroticize equality. And if you think what feminist sex or egalitarian sex will be eroticizing equality, maybe it will never happen. And so my question is more, okay, like in the current state of the world where there are power dynamics everywhere, where these power dynamics are eroticized, how do we think about good sex, about what a good one-night stand should be? Because what I'm interested in is to say there is something like a morally good one-night stand. There is something like a morally good friends with benefit. There is something like a morally good marital sex on a Sunday night. And so what does it look like?
And a large part of the question, which you've alluded to here and there, but I think we should also sort of center on it for a moment, is the problem of how we can ask this question within a world with very clear social structures of dominance and of power, and with a lot of long inherited ideas that are patriarchal in nature. You could say something like a classical marital contract is in a way a BDSM contract because somebody is signing that she will submit to her husband, and this is very gendered. So there is an idea of submissiveness that most laws in the West have abolished in their legal systems, but that is still sort of playing a part. And I think you alluded to it at the very beginning of our conversation already. There is this idea that men want sex and women accept sex. And this is also part of the setting. So the whole setting and the whole question, as many times in feminism, is how do we deal with the status quo? How do we develop ideas of better worlds, but at the same time, stay realistic in what is the world in which we are now? We cannot say that men and women are in the same way free to consent. That is, in a way, the claim, no?
Yes, so I think this book is a very clear sequel of my first book. So my first book is about how femininity is actually submissiveness, and how the way women are raised and are shaped by society is to be submissive, to put other people's desires before theirs, to have a hard time knowing what they want, saying what they want, etc. And so, of course, if you reach that conclusion that this is what is done to women, you can be very skeptical of the liberal consent form, because if women are taught to put other people's desires before theirs, to not say what they want, to be punished every time they say no to something, or to be punished or seen as bossy every time they express themselves, how are they going to be able to enter as equal in a sexual negotiation? So that's not possible.
Or just and simply, how would they say no in a sexual situation if they don't say no in any other situation?
Exactly. And so you see, the liberal model, it presupposes that there's initial equality. But what we know is that there is initial inequality. And so how do we go from their inequality towards something hopefully more equal? And so I think there in Germany right now, there's a lot of discussion about no means no, you know. And it comes from the fact that I think it's in 2016 that the law on rape has been changed, because up until 2016 in Germany, you could only be raped if violence was exerted during the rape. And so it was seen as a huge feminist change that the rape was defined by gegen der erkennbaren Willen. So the notion of consent was entering, so that it was against your will. Sex against your will was rape. But so people said, well, it means that you need to show that you don't want it. So you need to say no, etc. But one of the things I show in the book is that there are linguistic studies that show that you never say no in real life when people offer you something that you don't want. No one says no. If you were to ask me, do you want us to go have a drink after our discussion? I would say, and I really don't like you, I would not say no. I would say, well, I would have loved to. Unfortunately, I really can't. And maybe you would say, well, another time. And I say, oh, yeah, sure, another time. And I would make sure to keep it very vague so that you would hopefully at some point get the memo that I don't want it, but that I can't just say no to you. But
it wouldn't be polite.
It wouldn't be polite. And especially for women, saying no, especially if a man asks them something, is going to be seen as extremely rude and extremely polarizing. You know, like this is the whole, oh, she's such a bitch. You know, like you see it in the workplace when a female boss says no to another person. Everyone is like, oh, yeah, she's so bossy. She's so strict. She's so this. She's so that. And so expecting women to say no when a man is trying to have sex with them is an incredibly high standard. And we also know that one of the things that patriarchy does is that men don't like to be said no to because they feel entitled, especially to sex. And so women know statistically that when you say no to a man who wants to have sex with you, the likelihood that he's going to get really mad at you and maybe violent is pretty high. And so studies show that a lot of the non-voluntary sex that women have is because they're scared of being raped. And so it seems paradoxical, right, that they have non-consented sex out of being fear of being raped. But this is, like, a lot of studies show this. So women think, okay, like, at least I force myself, but it's not him violently raping me, or and therefore I don't have all these cultural narratives that I'm a rape victim and will I ever overcome it, etc. And so we see, like, there's no even playing field. And so some people say, oh, yeah, but then men need to listen to, are you saying yes? And so you have all of this in the US that only yes means yes, and your yes should be enthusiastic, should be this, should be that. And here you see again a view that rape would occur because men and women are different and don't understand themselves. It's the whole, you know, men come from Mars, women come from Venus. When women say no, men don't hear them. So that it would be a problem of interpretation. And so what I'm trying to say in the book is to say it's not a problem of interpretation. Actually, there are psychology studies that show that if you show men and women clips of non-consent, they identify it just as well. It's just that men are taught socially that they can not care about women not wanting to have sex with them in the case of heterosexual sex. And so the question is, how do we change things so that through sex, we're trying to build equality. We're never going to try to build equality completely. I'm not this sort of a liberal who think everything can be solved at an individual level. But I think it's a bit like in Spider-Man, you know, the whole with great powers comes great responsibility. It's the same in sex. If you are a man having heterosexual sex, it's on you to make sure that your partner can choose or choose not to have sex with you. And it doesn't mean just listening to her. It means saying something like, hey, like, just so you know, I'm really excited at the prospect of having sex with you, but if you've changed your mind, it's really cool and we can do that another day or never. Or, you know, that it's not just a matter of interpreting the signs of the other. It's a matter of how do we create a realm that takes into account how we're socially shaped. So create a realm in which men say, look, I'm not the cliche of men absolutely want sex and feel entitled to you. And I also know that you're not necessarily a cliche of women to whom sex is done.
Yes, because, I mean, the basic problem that we are dealing with here, I mean, what your book brings out wonderfully is that non-consensual sex, or at least not morally good sex, is not rare. It's not what happens in a dark night on a parking lot. It is extremely common. And part of it is sort of legally irrelevant, one could say, because there is a grey zone. There is me not knowing my own will on both sides, by the way. I mean, also independently of the sort of hunter-prey paradigm. But there is a problem of social clichés of gender that influences the whole notion of consent. And we have to do two things at the same time. If we want to have consent, we should probably abolish patriarchal cliches of gender. But we do have to have sex in the meantime. So we need to do this at the same time. We need to continue to have sex. Well, maybe we don't, but generally people do want to have sex. And if you want to do that before all these cliches are abolished, all this idea that men always want sex and women never want sex, and then you just have to sort of interpret if she's agreeing enough or just enough or not quite enough. How do we do this? How does this work? What is the sort of optimistic outlook? And I think you've probably sort of mentioned quite a few of these things already, but maybe just sort of as a final point, I mean, how does it look, this type of trying to have better, morally better sex in the conditions in which we are now?
So it's funny because I think what I'm advocating for at the end, and I feel a bit uncool about this, is just to be polite about sex. And that sounds really dull and really not very sexy, but I'm very...
But why does it not sound sexy? That's the problem. Because
so it
we imagine
sound...
sex as being animalistic as opposed to polite.
Yes, but also because I think we imagine that politeness is a sort of minimal behavior you should have towards other people. And that, of course, in sex, we should want passion, we should want this, we should want that, we should want pleasure. And that politeness sounds very formal and minimal, but actually, it's very rare that we have polite sex, or at least it's not the majority of sex that fits the norms of politeness as care for the other person, what they want, what Kant would say, like respect them as ends and not just treat them as means. And indeed, you're right. There's this question of having animalistic desires, etc. But how many people do we know that told us, oh yeah, like this guy, he was great and or he was a friend, etc. And we had sex and now he's treating me like I'm a below human, you know? And there's this sort of idea that once you've had sex with people, they enter a realm where you don't have duties towards them like you have towards every other person in your life. And so I'm interested in this. And so I think it comes from the fact that we have Puritan intuitions about sex being not just animalistic, but dirty, that like we did something a bit shameful with these people, etc. And so what I'm trying to say is to say, well, actually, sex is a very important part of human existence. And we need to talk about sex a lot to kind of sacralize it, but not in the negative sense, but in the positive sense of thinking about sex as one of the core experiences in life that make the good life a good life. And so how can we manage that if we never talk about it? So I'm going to have a very French comparison, but I think it's a useful one. So in France, you have all these people who say, oh yeah, if you talk about sex, like it's going to make it non-sacred, non-pleasurable, it's going to kill the vibe, etc. But these same people, they would never go to a very good restaurant alone, because the whole joy, the whole pleasure of tasting fantastic food is immensely increased by the fact that you share it with someone. That is a joint endeavor, that you talk about, oh, see how this fish is cooked and this, oh, this zucchini, it's firm but grilled. But and so my question is, why do we think about sex as something completely different from this? And I think it's because we're embarrassed to talk about sex. And I think this embarrassment diminishes as we talk more about sex.
That's a wonderful French ending, the culinary ending. We move towards a world in which various bodily functions, not just eating, could be part of polite society and of shared conversations. Thank you very much, Manon Garcia, for this conversation in Deutschlandfunk Kultur.
Thank you very much.